adopted a path of least responsibility to this talk, so I'm talking about somebody else's work. If you don't like it, it's not my problem. And so this paper by Daniela and Renato, there'll be a second version soon, but all the essentials is there. And it's about how single world interpretations of quantum theory are not consistent in the sense that you cannot consistently compare the points of views of different observers, and you cannot reason about what other people are thinking. Okay, and just to prime you about why this should be a problem, I'm going to give you a very classical example. We're physicists, we love puzzles, so you might know this puzzle. So there's a box with 5 hats, okay, and 2 are black, and 3 are white. And then there's 3 people here. Alice, Bob, and Charlie. And hats are drawn at random from this box and given to them. And they're sitting like this such that they can only see in this direction. Okay? And the goal is, well, the game is when you know the color of your hat, say something. Okay? Or if you want to play it in a different way, you can play it like there's a bell that will ring every 10 minutes, and every 10 minutes someone can make a guess if they are sure what the color of their hat is. Okay? So, and what has happened in this particular instance is that the bell rings once and nothing happens, the bell rings twice and nothing happens, and when the bell rings the third time, this person guesses the color of the hat. Okay? Now you can think about how this works, and I'll tell you in a bit. It's very handful. It's very helpful because I'll need to be writing a lot there, so you have some time to think about it. Okay, but the idea is here is that to solve this problem, this person will have to think about what these other people are seeing and thinking. Okay? It's great because now I could spend 5 minutes just not speaking and you'd be paying so much attention. Okay. Now I'm going to explain the setting of the thought experiment that is the basis of this paper. Okay? And it's kind of it's a mixture of Wigner's friend experiment, in the sense that are observers that measure observers, and Hardy's paradox. So here's time, and you have one agent, I call her Alice. She's sitting inside a lab, and she has a quantum state of some system C. Which is in this state. So this is heads and tails of system C. Okay. And she's going to measure this in this basis, and if she gets heads, she's going to prepare a second quantum system, a qubit, for example, either in this state, can you see in the back? Or if she measures tails, she prepares it in the down. So just to be clear, this means up plus down. Okay. Now, she's isolated except for a little quantum channel where she can send one, where she can send system S to a second player, Bob. Okay. Here's Bob. And all that Bob is going to do is going to measure this qubit S. Okay, let's say here Alice got some outcome, which was heads or tails. Bob is going to measure this S in this basis. He gets some outcome, which is plus one or minus one. And then there's someone else sitting outside, which is Wigner. In the original paper, this is two people, if this helps you. So let's say this was time 0. She does this at time 10. Bob does this at time 20. Time 30. Wigner is going to measure Alice, and I'll tell you in a bit in what basis he measures. So he's going to measure Alice and get some outcome. Okay. So the outcome will be okay or fail, where okay this measurement and fail. Okay. And then at a later time, you'll do the same for Bob. So we'll get some WB. I haven't told you yet what this system is. So you'll see that is the total system of this lab. What I want to do is set you up. Let's see what the systems involved are and what the state of the system is. From a global perspective, what the state of these two labs is. Okay? And I start, so at time equals 0, Alice, let's say that Alice equals the coin tensor, some internal memory of Alice, and Bob will equal S tensor, some internal memory of Bob. And now at time equals 0, all that we have is this 2/3 coin, some initial state, let's call it like this, of Alice, some initial state of S, some initial state of Bob. At time equals 10, Alice does her measurement. So from above, she becomes entangled with this coin, right? So then we get head of the coin. This is Alice prime. Alice prime, and she does this on S. Tails, coin, tails, Alice prime, down, S, B prime. And because I don't want to write all of this round, I just call this head of Alice, of this Alice that is a composite system, okay? It's not too important. Now, what happens at time equals 20. Now Bob measured. Okay. Yeah. So now we have 2 over 3 heads on Alice. Let's say up first. Up on the system plus 1 on Bob prime. Down on system plus 1 on Bob prime. Tails on Alice, down on the system, and measure minus 1. Right. And again, I just call this 1 of Bob, and I just call this minus 1 of Bob. And these are the bases in which he will be measured later on. Okay. So what we have here is already the hardest state, because we can write it as 1 over square root of 3 heads plus 1 Alice and Bob plus heads minus 1 plus tails minus 1. And the fundamental point for what's to come is that you can group it like this, and then you have minus 1 on Bob and fail on Alice, or you can group this two, and this is just heads on Alice and fail on Bob. Okay. And just to, I'll not write the whole thing, but this has some overlap. This set has some overlap with OK. So if they play this game enough times, okay, so the idea is they play this game once, measure, see if they get OK. If not, they get new friends, prepare the set again from the beginning, do it again many times. At some point, because it has some overlap with OK, they will get OK. So now we post-select, we go through this case in which they get okay. And now let's apply this reasoning. So has everyone solved this problem here? Yes? No? Yes. Okay. So what happens is, so the bell rings the first time and nobody says anything. So Bob and Charlie learned that it couldn't be black, right? Because otherwise Alice would have known that her hat was white. Okay, so they know that black is forbidden. And then when it rings a second time, then Charlie thinks, well, he knows that it's not black, so if you're seeing black, then he wouldn't have known that his hat was white. So it can also not be black. What? So then I know that my hat is white. Yeah. Okay. And what we use here was really this chain about reasoning about what other people are thinking.
Hey, can I challenge that? Why isn't just chain of reasoning about what other people are saying?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, for your argument, which I sort of...
Yes, fair enough. But you also have to reason about why they're saying this, and for this you have to reason about what they see and they think.
Some modeling, that's true.
Okay. Good. I really shouldn't have done this in these two blackboards, but... So this is fun. Okay. So now what happens will be the same. So they got okay. So now Wigner, at this stage, so before this measurement is performed, he's going to think about what Bob has seen. Okay? He only measured Alice, Bob is still here. And what he's going to think is, well, if I got okay, then looking at this stage, well, Bob could only have gotten plus one because minus one only has overlap with fail. Okay? So then he thinks, well, then Bob got plus one. Well, we use this second grouping here. So plus one has some overlap of half with OK, but minus one doesn't. So then it's certain that Bob saw this. So then he thinks, well, then what would have Bob at this stage have concluded about what Alice saw? And then you can see, well, Bob saw plus one, right? So for sure, Alice must have seen heads, because the only way for him to see plus one is if the stage was this one, right? So then we have that Bob, if Bob sees plus one, then he concludes that Alice saw heads. And now Alice is going to think about, okay, so now Bob thinks about what Alice would have predicted that Wigner would have gotten in this outcome. Okay? And here what Alice thinks is, well, if I got heads, then I prepared this state, but this state just corresponds to fail, right? So heads only has overlap with fail up there. Okay. This is the contradiction, right? Are there questions at this stage?
You make it even a little better by doing it in such a way that Wigner makes sure that the first measurement is okay, but then not performing the second measurement at that stage.
And only performing it yet.
So Wigner would conclude that the second measurement has a positive probability of getting okay.
Mm-hmm.
No, sorry, that doesn't help. Excuse me. Because I just wanted to avoid Alice having been measured at this stage. But that's nonsense.
Yes. Well, it's a prediction that she makes.
Yes. No, sorry.
It's a prediction that she makes at this time. If she sees head. And the reason we believe she saw head is because here we saw K, so we believe that she saw plus one, so we believe that she.
But all this starts at the stage when Alice is already destroyed.
Yes. Yes, yes. But it's not a prediction that we ask Alice to do at the end, it's a prediction, yes. And in particular, this prediction will no longer exist by the time Wigner gets this okay here. Okay. So there's a lot of fuss about this paper. I mean, deservedly so. And people started thinking about what ways around them there are. So one way around this is to say, okay, we don't believe in quantum theory. We don't believe that quantum theory applies at all levels. We cannot measure. Like, these measurements are very realistic measurements. Okay, so one option would be, this, and I'll go in detail into forms of this. The other option would be to just reject this single world, and by single world, I mean this. The idea that we needed to do all this chain of reasoning was that At each point, each observer only saw one definite outcome. Okay, so you can reject this idea. So in particular, if here, okay, this is the approach of an anonymous Romanian physicist. Says, well, if here Alice thinks that I might be seeing heads, but this is not the full story because I know that I obtained this by measuring this state, and if I do a more careful analysis, then I get a, considering that I myself may be in a superposition, then of course I get a non-zero probability for this outcome. Good. And the other option is to reject this idea that self-consistency is important and that it's important to make this kind of chains of reasoning. Okay. So this, by the way, is a theorem, which is why most of the paper, like the beginning of the paper, is developed to this framework that allows us to prove this, like that you cannot have the three of them as a contradiction. Okay, so there's many ways of rejecting quantum theory. One would be just saying, well, we cannot measure macroscopic systems. Fine. The other one would be saying, we can, but then the results are different from what's predicted by quantum theory. Okay, it's not been tested. The other one would be saying, well, we can, but we can't measure observers. So in case you're curious, Bohmian mechanics falls into this one. Because in this case, so if you apply Bohmian mechanics, okay, I'm not speaking for myself, I'm speaking. So this is like third end. Charlie Gonstein's explanation would be that if you apply Bohmian mechanics to the whole universe, so from the above, if you try to apply to individual subsystems, you get a contradiction. But if you apply to the whole, then Alice gets a different prediction than here. Okay. So from Alice's perspective, this is very simple, right? I measure something, I store this in some memory, and then I prepare a system, and all that Wigner does is measure this system, right? Okay, the system suffers some unitary evolution, but that's not so important. Okay, in this case, Bohmian mechanics tells us that the probabilities for Wigner's outcomes, as predicted by Alice, are not the same. So it really differs from quantum theory. Okay. Okay, this is stupid, right? Because it's just dodging the question. This is like saying we are special snowflakes. That never led anywhere.
Yeah. It only disagrees with quantum theory because of Wigner's first measurement. In a sense. Like, if...
Yes.
If Alice hadn't been recapitulated, then...
Yes.
You could get them.
Yes. Okay. So yeah, what some other people say is that maybe if Alice to be able to make a prediction, she needs to store this system, her information into memory, and there's some fundamental decoherence going on in the memory that would not allow Wigner to later make the measurement. So I think this is, for example, no, I'll not say names. Okay. A named British physicist. Idea. But again, this is not very, it's not very attractive to me. Because why would the memory be a system different, like a quantum system different from all the others? If the others can be measured, why not the memory? Okay. So the other option is to reject the single worlds, and so we can have this idea that more than one outcome is real. In the many world sense, okay? In the sense that we cannot write this story that Wigner only saw that and Bob only saw that and Alice only saw that. And if you want, I can go into more detail here. I'm still not sure where to put cubism. I'll put it either here or here. So the reason would be, if I put it here, it would be just saying that no outcome is real in any way. But from the latest iteration, interaction with Renato, it seems that you could still apply all the framework developed to states of belief, and the theorem would still go through. But this is still untested. Okay, the other thing you can say about that cubism would say is that, well, the self-consistency is not important in this case because, okay, so let's put here. So that the self-consistency is not important at this stage because Alice's prediction will never reach the point where it can be contradicted. So in the sense, if you take cubism as a decision theory, that Alice would never lose money in making that prediction because the record of the prediction no longer exists at this stage. Okay. I think these are the main things about this framework. I expect questions at this stage. Yes.
I'm suspicious about putting bone in the rejected. I think it's like you could say that the fact that point bone reproduces quantum theory as a theorem too. But it must be certain types of projections within the bone point framework that don't go through.
I don't know this. Well, but I know that this is the
stage at which they are now.
One thing is be careful that the very strange non-local influences in bone, which can, you know, so you can't rely on inferences made, you know, after. So Wigner is doing something in the meantime, and that can mess up predictions that were made. So anyway, I feel like
I need
to sit down and analyze it. But there are some very strange situations where you think you can make a prediction, but actually there's non-local influences that mess up your inference. You know, A implies B. You have to be careful what the context of A is. If you change the context, then the inference no longer goes through. And I'm worried about the context being changed.
Why don't you tell
maybe
us?
Maybe something more of a comment than a question. So, I mean, there's one thing is sort of methodology. I mean, is problematic about putting cubism in one of these boxes because I don't think it fits the framework itself.
Yes.
So these three alternatives, they're formalized within a particular framework, which is based about the idea of telling stories.
Yes.
So that the task of physical theory is to tell a story, and then self-consistency means that the story where the stories of different participants overlap, then the stories must be identical on the overlap. That's something like this. Now, if you have a theory like cubism that doesn't tell stories, but just makes predictions, then this whole concept doesn't really make sense.
Yes, yes.
And that means that putting cubism there isn't really quite right.
Okay, so this is what I thought 1 hour ago. Sorry, by now, 1.5 hours ago. and since then, spoken to Renato, and while he agrees that cubism does not fit the spirit of the framework, you can still write your stories being stories about the belief of one observer and that and say that, okay, and we have some belief that everything still goes through, and you still reach the contradiction.
Cubism is just simply not the case that as far as Vigna is concerned, there are no experiences of Alice and Bob until such time
as
you verify
it.
So how can you make
that's this. So it's rejecting self-consciousness, like not caring about Alice's.
I don't know if it's rejecting self-consistency, it's just it's to me, it's more, although, okay, Rudiger's not going to agree with this, but to me, it's more in the spirit of rejecting single world, in the sense that there's the perspectives of the different agents just can't be combined, right? So Vigna has, but Alice, Bob, and Vigna each have their own private experiences, but there's no such thing as Vigna being able to reason about Alice and Bob's private experiences when he describes them as being in the superposition. Just, you know,
not at that stage, no, but. So this reasoning could go through. They could even talk at this stage. They could even ask.
Because Bob is absolutely sure that this is plus one. So, at this stage, Bob is not in a superposition relative to Vigna when he makes this prediction. And the same here.
But you're reasoning not about what they see now, you're reasoning about what they have seen.
Yes.
Which, and at the time that they saw those things, they can describe them as being in superposition, so he doesn't have any right to talk about. Like, as far as Vigna's concerned, there is no fact of the matter about what Bob had seen at an earlier time or what Alice had seen at an earlier time.
Let me reply in a minute, please.
Well, it's kind of connected to just one comment where you just said that. I think the idea here is that if you postulate that nonetheless there's some matter of fact about what Bob saw or what Al saw, then that warrants Vigner to think, okay, well, what inferences would have been made? And it's sort of a proof by contradiction, reductio ad absurdum. Like, if I posit that there was some matter of fact, despite the supposition, then I land into this trouble.
That's precisely
this is what
Cubism
said
denies.
What's that?
That's precisely what Cubism denies.
Okay.
Yes.
So let me ask a different question. I'm just trying to understand the reasoning.
But then I'd agree with you that it denies single world. Yes, go ahead.
So in the context of your epistemic logic example, there, you know, the idea is that every agent is presumed to know that every other agent is reasoning completely rationally. And so if by their behavior some other agent gives me some evidence of how they've reasoned, then I trust that they've reasoned correctly, and I can take that evidence in my own reasoning. So I never have any doubts about the reasoning capabilities of the other agents.
Yes.
Right? So here it seems like something similar is going on. Vigner's saying, okay, I've got some evidence, and now I'm going to trust any inferences that, under the assumption that Alice and Bob are having well-defined experiences, I'm going to trust any inferences that they would have made, and if I get to a contradiction, then there's a problem. But this is the step I don't understand, which is, why would Vigner think that Bob would reason that B is equal to plus implies A is equal to H? Because Bob does not assign the quantum state that he wrote above, which is what supports that implication. He assigns a different quantum state. So why would Bob use Vigner's quantum state to make his inferences? That's what I'm missing.
So if Bob's is plus one. Sorry, Bob can think of the joint quantum state of the coin and the system only. And that would be okay. And then he can still infer that if I see.
Isn't that presuming that Bob decides to consider himself as part of some giant quantum state? Which seems a bit odd.
No, you can't just think H of A.
You can think that he's given this state. Sorry.
It's still much simpler. Bloch just sees a measurement outcome on the basis of that measurement outcome alone.
Yes.
Inferences about what Alice saw.
He measures this, and he knows that if he got, he measures S, and he knows that if he got up, then Alice must have done this. He does not need to think of himself as a quantum system at this stage.
That's
you can't read this. It's too yellow?
It's just yellow.
Okay.
It's okay.
Is it too small or too yellow?
There's just too much glare. Right, so that's strictly speaking A prime and B prime that you're writing a state for there?
No, I'm writing a state for Alice and system.
Oh, okay.
So from Watt's perspective, this is so terrible.
It's just the T equals 10 state up there, right? Without B prime.
That
is also a paradox.
Okay.
Right? Plus coefficients. He does not need to think of himself as a quantum system at this stage.
Okay.
Just returning to the phone thing. So there's sort of theorems showing that so in the Dvorak-Bohm model, you can satisfy that that the distribution of particles is given by psi squared in one given foliation of the wave function as it evolves. Mm-hmm. But what you can't do is reason. You can't satisfy that in multiple different foliations. Even doing one foliation. And in fact, you can use this sort of foliations to see exactly that. I'm wondering if that's what's happening here. Is there effectively more than one kind of reference? Are there inferences being made that would require you to look in different kinds of reference, or effectively look across foliations? In this case. So you have a clear time sequence, but some of the inferences seem to go forward and some are going backwards, is that right? Or go across each other?
The inferences?
Yeah.
That we're making? Yes,
because
back and forward.
Sorry? Back and forward, okay.
Back forward, yes.
Okay. So that would be the problem with the Dvorak-Bohm. You can't satisfy precise threading more than one frame of reference or basis. So is that, I'm not sure if that counts as violating quantum theory or not.
Okay, does anyone else know anything about
which perspective?
I don't think there's any, you're only using one frame of reference, like in the relativistic sense. I think you're right that this is the same fact about quantum theory that also prevents you from having quite a square degree on multiple reference rates. Mm-hmm. But I think this is the conclusion here is not just saying. I think Wayne's way of putting it at the weekend was very helpful, which is that so, like Alice, when she gets her outcome and then she assigns this right and down state to X, that might just look like a kind of humdrum application of quantum theory. But from a Bohmian perspective, you have to think, well, hang on, Alice is some part of this huge wave function. So what's going on there? And you would find that the normal story is that the conditional wave function of S, given what Alice has learned from seeing her measurement outcome, is right or left or down. And conditional wave functions normally behave just like ordinary wave functions in quantum theory, but that assumes some kind of decoherence type phenomenon. And that's violated by Wigner's measurement at t equals 30. And so up to t equals 30, Alice doesn't do anything wrong by sort of assigning the state right and down and using regular quantum theory. But at t equals 30, she needs to go back to thinking about the global wave function, the whole thing, because it's at that point the assumptions that go into I mean, the conditional wave function behaves like the normal wave function behaves by.
Can I make another attempt to say why I don't think that cubism fits the framework?
Yes.
So, I mean, Wigner does not, cubist Wigner does not care about Alice's, and doesn't even, totally doesn't care about Alice and Bob's beliefs. Wigner doesn't assume that Alice and Bob have beliefs until Wigner actually makes a measurement and confirms. So Wigner does care. Wigner actually might care, make prediction about what Alice will tell him about her beliefs.
Yes.
And then so Wigner makes his predictions, and then Wigner can ask Alice, and if Wigner's predictions are correct, then Alice will confirm that. Now, you will never, of course, in this context, never have any contradiction about Wigner's predictions of Alice's responses to him. Because Wigner either asked Alice early on at time t, t equal to 10, at time 10, mm-hmm. and then of course everything will be fine, or Wigner asked Alice after he had thanked her, and then again there will be no contradiction of any kind. So, I mean, this is what Matt said.
Yes, sure. I mean, I agree with this.
Yeah, so it doesn't fit in the framework, it doesn't tell a story. It doesn't tell a story about what happened before the measurement.
You can still make a guess about what happened in the past. It does not make sense for him to bet any money on this because he'll never be able to confirm this expert.
He can do this, but then he is not a cubist.
Yes. Okay. Fair enough.
And one last comment. You mentioned you seem to imply a difference between the case where so you seem to somehow imply that if Wigner makes a probability one prediction,
Wigner
can predict an outcome with certainty.
Yes.
Then it's fine to assume that that there was a factual situation before the measurement. And again, he was in the night.
Yes, sure. But still, wouldn't you want to have a theory that could describe and be applied to this kind of problem?
Well, if I had one to bomb, then this would convince me there isn't one. I like this.
Okay.
Lydia.
Yeah.
Another question about the epistemic logic. So, I understand now how Wigner can rely on Bob's inference because Bob's inference just relies upon Bob's quantum state. Then I look over at the inference he wrote below Alice, and that does refer to system B. So should I think of that? It seems like, unlike your example of the three agents, isn't it sufficient for Wigner to say Bob would have made an inference from B is equal to plus to A is equal to H, and I trust Bob to be rational and his inferences to be correct, but now I go back to my quantum state and I say if A is H, then I infer that I should have gotten fail on WB, on B, and that contradicts what I actually saw, which was okay.
Know at this stage that A is not... Yeah. You know at this stage that A no longer exists.
That
A no longer exists. So
well, you notice the stage that you have a superposition of H and T, right? Because
yes.
You have OK, so you have to state H minus T.
Okay. So you can trust Bob's reasoning that at some point A was H.
Mm-hmm.
But then what you said later was, so I can come back to the future, to where I am now,
mm-hmm.
and see that if A is H, then right. I get this outcome.
But am I right that kind of there's only one step of epistemic logic? Wigner asks himself, how would Bob reason according to his quantum states? And then the rest of the reasoning happens with Wigner's quantum state. There's no two steps. There's Bob's quantum state, and then there's appeal to Alice's quantum state, and then it's back to Wigner. It sounds like it's just two steps to Bob and back.
me. You mean in the sense that in order to make... No. Because I can do the same for Alice as I did for Bobo, yeah.
I mean,
right. And just write the state from the point of view of Alice.
You could, but it wouldn't, insofar as your inference on the far left refers to system B, and Alice is, you know, doesn't have any access to system B. B is.
No, but she knows what's going to happen with system B.
Well, if she can make any inference about system B, then she has to write down a quantum state. So, for B, but so maybe you just need to show me what the quantum state is. I thought that inference came from the quantum state you wrote at the top right. So maybe you can point me to the other quantum state that it does come from, and you can resolve my confusion the same way you did before.
Okay, so it's kind of the same set, but with different labels, so she's... It's not even a quantum set, it's just I do S. So I have this on S, so I look. Fed on board. I mean, the quantum state actually makes inference about this Bob's quantum state conditioned on what you know. I'm not sure if this is answering your question.
I'll talk about it later. Right.
Okay.
Thanks.
Does anyone want to comment on this? Yes.
So this is a vague comment. Yes. I don't know where doing it. It seems that locality is playing some sort of a crucial role here, because I've been trying to think about whether you can play any kind of similar game with just a Cauchy's backend type, with just a contextuality proof. And I can't see how to make any reasoning go through there. So it seems like the fact that this is a non-locality proof is playing a crucial role. But I can't quite see exactly what the role of locality is here. Like, what's it doing for you that just, you know, that just the fact that there are situations where you can't make counterfactual inferences, like in the contextuality proof, doesn't do. It's kind of a vague question, but it seems. I'm worried that there's some kind of hidden locality or something.
Okay, I don't know.
But so the reason you can't do it with a contextuality proof is that there's no assumption of that contextuality.
Sure, but there's no assumption of locality here either.
Right.
There's...
But the single world assumption gets you the same as you would get. Like a different conceptual assumption that mathematically does.
Yes, I sort of determinism in some sense, at least after the measurements that we've done, that goes back to the math.
It gets you a joint distribution.
And why do you get that joint distribution? You get it because your assumptions imply that if you repeat this experiment many, many times, then the relative frequencies and all the relative things exist, because they're part of this story.
Mm.
So in some sense, the joint distribution is coming from something that's equivalent to a determinism, like there's a fact of the matter and each relative thing's going
on. You could call it that, but it's not measurement results being determined before they happen is than being determined after they happen.
Sure, sure. I know, but it's like if you translate it back into a Bell proof, what you're using here is equivalent to in Bell proof. It's like determined. So it's like, okay. So then why don't you get determinism if you do a
is relatively realistic.
Is it really about measurements after they happened? Because in a certain sense, the measurement really never happened, this is said, at least as seen from Wigner. So we only think it should have happened if we take it seriously that Alice is an agent, maybe a physical system, a macroscopic system, and then we usually say, oh, now the outcome is there.
The assumption is that there's a fact as a measure about what Alice and Bob saw. I mean,
yeah.
Wigner can deny all the reasoning if he says, oh, there was actually no effect in the matter about what they saw. But you need to assume that it was the fact of the matter and you can reason about it even if they know what it is.
Yeah, indeed.
So that's why it's sort of like, you know, if there's a fact of the matter on each run, then you can sort of say, okay, well, it must be some deterministic values that I can assign to these variables on each run. Is that that gets you into difficulty. But I mean, the same thing is true of contextuality. Like, if you consider a contextuality group, you can say it means that there's no joint probability distribution over all of the observables in this group. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, I can't derive that.
I think you can, actually. Thinking of the example that Matt used in London with the belt there, you'd have to do more on doing unitaries, but I think you could just make all six measurements in a transparent square.
Okay, consider this. Like, imagine you're doing three books per box, right? So, you know, at the beginning, you prepare 1 plus 2 plus 3. At the end, like here, there's going to be like a selection on 1 plus 2 minus 3. Okay, then you have sort of Alice in the middle who measures 1 versus 2, 3, then gets a brain erased and decohered, and then she measures 2 versus 1, 3. Okay. Then you're gonna infer, she must have seen 1 in the first measurement and she must have seen 2 in the second measurement. But there's no sort of contradiction here because there doesn't seem to be a contradiction there in that experiment, like there is.
There's only one part in that experiment, right?
Well, that's the whole point. I'm like saying, what's the role of having two? I'm trying to understand what's the role of having two parts.
So I think the reason you don't get a contradiction there is there's no reason to assume that potentiality, right? You're like happy that the first time round Alice saw something, second time round she saw something else. And you're happy with that being different because they were different contexts. And you're not assuming that potentiality. Right? Like, that's why that's not a paradox that we just explained.
Okay, sure.
And in a bell proof, the thing that plays the role of non-contextuality is parameter independence. So we need to understand where parameter independence is coming from.
Okay.
So.
So in the bell proof, you need, for all we're doing, you need parameter independence and determinant. We've understood where determinant is functional. So we have to figure out where in the proof that's being used. So Alice and Bob don't have two choices of measurements, so we just make that.
Well, the thing that corresponds to the two choices is whether you talk about Alice's outcome or Wigner's first measurement, and whether you talk about Bob's outcome or Wigner's second measurement. Like, if you look at how this maps to the Hartley paradox, that's what maps to the two settings.
I suppose we're assuming that when you cohere Alice, like we think we're making the final measurement, that doesn't change what we've seen in this lab. But that's the parameter. That's the equivalent of parameter. I guess Bob's outcome can't depend on the choice of measurements on the Alice one. Right, so you're assuming you've got this thing, you're putting it down on a piece of paper, whatever. When you recalculate Alice, it doesn't doesn't change what's written down in the books.
So that just sounds like a network of causalities.
Well, I think it's a. So
maybe we should discuss this afterwards.
Okay. I mean, when I wrote that paper first, I also advertised it as an argument against Lorentzian variance at the grade level. And then there were comments by Brandon and Goldstein, actually called. And they persuaded me that there was a problem with that argument, and it was to do with being careful about the context that you're making different inferences with respect to. And I wonder if what they wrote in that comment might be applicable here too. This was all back in the 90s. Might be interesting.
Yes. Okay. Let's wrap it up.
Thanks.